Yes.
All right, the House Committee on Transportation Economic Development for February 7th will come to order. We're going to welcome everyone. We're going to go a little out of order this morning. We're going to go with House Bill 2136 first because one of the witnesses has to leave. So who is going to testify first? And before you say anything, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2136.
Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Deputy Director for Central Services for Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me at the table is Maureen Bach, who is the manager of our Fuel Stacks program. We're here today to testify on House Bill 2136. This bill would amend current Oregon statute to allow electronic filing of fuel tax reports prepared by licensees and taxpayers. The new system will improve efficiency, make it easier for providers to file for licenses and file their taxes, will allow us to move from a paper-based system to an electronic system, and increase the amount we collect in fuel taxes. We currently have the funding for this project in our budget, so there's no fiscal impact for this change. And with that, I'll turn it over to Maureen.
Good afternoon, Representative Dentz, Representative Reed, member of the committee. My name is Maureen Bach. I am the fuel tax manager for ODOT, and I'm going to walk you through this handout that was given to you by your committee assistant. Currently, ODOT collects fuel tax on gasoline and gas blends, diesel, and other fuels that are used in motor vehicles. We've been collecting about $36 million a month in fuel taxes before the tax increase, and with the tax increase, we anticipate revenues to increase by about $5 to $6 million a month. And fuel tax is imposed on each gallon of fuel, and currently the rate for gas and gas blends is 30 cents a gallon, and the gas, jet fuel, and aviation gas are the three kinds of motor fuels that we collect taxes on. Aviation gas and jet fuel are taxed at a lesser rate, and then used fuels are also known as special fuels in the federal system, and those are also taxed at 30 cents a gallon. And that includes diesel, biodiesel, propane, and compressed natural gas. Now, the complicating factor for fuels tax is we have a couple different taxation points. So we have motor vehicle fuel taxed at first distribution, and we have used fuel tax when it's placed in the fuel tank of a vehicle being used on the roads. Our current filing process, as Mr. Psyche said, is paper-based. We don't have an electronic filing portal for our different kinds of licensees, and so we also have no automated way to track fuel. So we get about 18,000 pieces of paper, and then when we go to audit or to track fuel, we pull out the pieces of paper and we match those fuel distribution loads up to see if we're getting all the tax to which we're entitled. So in the future, once we migrate to a new system, we anticipate that we will have an electronic filing portal for our licensees, which will be more efficient for them. It will also allow us to have an automated way to track fuel to its actual taxation point, which will be more efficient for us, more efficient for our licensees, and will improve our accounting and audit capability. So we need two things to accomplish this. We need a law change that allows for electronic filing, which this bill does, and we also need a new system that will enable electronic filing, and that's what we're working on currently. So we anticipate by investing in this technology, and once we get the system up and running, that we would be able to capture about an additional $10 million a year in revenue just by being able to track fuel. Are there any questions?
Questions? Representative Nathanson first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please talk a little bit about how the card lock system relates to this? And one of the reasons I'm asking is I've taken special note of information technology or IT projects and how they are often inadequate and not designed as a system to communicate with other systems that share the same information. And I'm wondering whether the card lock system, the data that has to be collected for that to ensure that only the authorized purchasers are purchasing through card lock, how any of that information is replicated or repeated through other systems that have to be maintained. So I'm looking for not only legal and financial relationships, but also technology relationships.
Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, that's a very good question. We do have some card locks that are licensed with us as sellers, and so they take their information and put it on our pieces of paper to send it to us and then apply the tax. So this would enable them to upload that information more easily so we could track what they should be reporting, because, as you know, card locks have both exempt and non-exempt purchases. So it would eliminate some of that duplicated effort for them.
Follow up?
Please.
So they'd be able to go online and put in the data electronically. I understand that. But is this going to be a separate database or system and not in direct linked communication with another system that card locks already have to use?
How they would structure their Representative Nathanson, member of the committee, we're not sure how they would upload their information to our portal. These systems are in place in other jurisdictions, and we're just starting to explore this right now, so I really don't know the answer to that question in any definite detail at this point.
Just a brief conclusion. Then I hope that the department will consult with either EISPD and Department of Administrative Services or somewhere else to make sure that we're optimizing our abilities with technology instead of just replicating more things that don't talk to each other and doing things two or three times.
Representative Nathanson, let me assure you that we have already submitted the paperwork to DAST for oversight on this effort.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, I think I heard you both say that the additional dollars you contemplate here, I heard you say that, and I wanted to clarify, those are dollars that are already owed. It's just the system you're using now that's preventing you from collecting those dollars. Is that right?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I'm not sure I'd say preventing us. It's sometimes we don't know who should be paying us tax because of the taxation point being at the point of sale. So many of the people who distribute gasoline also distribute diesel. We collect that information on paper, but we don't really know, have ways to pour through all the pieces of paper to see who should be reporting on our used fuel seller side. So sometimes stations change hands and we don't know about it. So this allows us to more timely figure out who should be paying.
Maybe I could rephrase, Mr. Chair. Would it be accurate to say that this system will better allow your to collect money that is already owed?
Representative Reed, that is a fair summation.
Thanks very much.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk about the technology infrastructure that's going to be required of the reporting business, what they need to have in order to interact with the system?
Representative Sheehan, members of the committee, right now we are just doing requirements gathering. Most of the motor vehicle fuel distributors already have fuel systems that track fuel. So what they're doing is they are downloading their information and writing it on pieces of paper or putting it in Excel-like worksheets and sending it to us. So they already have information available electronically that they could upload to our portal, which is what is done in other states with these commercial off-the-shelf systems. A lot of the more sophisticated used fuel sellers, the truck stops and those kinds of businesses, also have electronic systems that capture the information that they need for reporting. The unknown quantity for us are some of the smaller sellers, people who only have one station that sells diesel, maybe one pump, or the used fuel users who buy their diesel in bulk and then report their use and whether or not they would actually do technology. We actually do anticipate that we would run, we would allow them to file paper if need be. So we would not mandate they have the cost of investing in technology if they didn't already have it.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Sure.
Is that, so it's not a web-based reporting tool?
Representative Shan, members of the committee, most of these systems are, they have a web portal that is secure for uploading that information. But we do have some small users who have one bulk tank primarily used for farm purposes, and they occasionally use them for on-road use, and they would probably send us a piece of paper report.
Okay, my big concern, I guess, would be that it's not like an application that's independent of a web browser that requires a certain operating system or anything like that.
No.
It's all web. Okay.
We anticipate it would be hosted by our system.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, this is surprises me that we have to have legislative action to move from paper to electronic. But the first thing that, my first question is that we've been talking about electronic processing, but I just searched the statute and nowhere is the word electronic in there. I just see in the manner provided by the department by rule. And my concern is that, two-part question, does that leave room for interpretation to drive a bus through sometime later? Number one. Then number two is there any way that dealers, their costs are going to increase with this? I'm assuming it's going to be more beneficial to everybody, but I'm just wondering if there's, number one, if this is such a broad reading as defined by the department by rule, number one. Then number two is there going to be any room for increase of cost on the dealer?
Representative Lindsay, members of the committee, we worked with the Petroleum Association on this language as well as our Attorney General to make sure that it was crafted appropriately. We don't know what the technology might be when we actually get around to acquiring the system, but we were assured that we couldn't currently do electronic filing with our system, that we need a hard copy signature on a piece of paper. So that's why we're working with this by rule language right now, is so we can continue to have those conversations with our licensees. As for the cost, most of the dealers have been pushing for this because it is a less costly alternative than packaging up pieces of paper to send to us, and it assures that they can get filing done more timely as well. So
I'm sure we'll hear from them if the costs do increase. So thank you.
And we are anticipating having them on our steering committee, so we are aware of what their requirements are as well.
Further questions? I have a couple. The timing of let's get this passed, and what happens next and when?
Oh, Representative Beth, members of the committee, we are in the process of setting up the project right now. We anticipate going through some requirements gathering, so timing-wise, if all goes well, I'm assuming we'd be implementing in, knock on wood, and this is just me, 2012-13 timeframe.
And I have to ask, as a result of the technology, how many fewer folks will be working at ODOT?
Representative Bench, members of the committee, probably none.
I don't know why that doesn't surprise me, but tell me what is the major benefit from the exercise other than the $10 million? This facilitates the collection of the funds, makes it easier for the folks collecting the tax for us, that is the petroleum marketers. And does it help ODOT do its job better? Other than, obviously it does, $10 million. But tell me what else we get out of it.
Representative Bench, members of the committee, currently we have a three-year statute of limitations to pursue people who have not paid. So we have a three-year period to audit. We are not currently staffed to get all those audits done. So we have people that sort of fall off and go out of business before we collect the tax to which we're entitled. So we're hoping that this will allow us to target our audits more specifically to people who should be reporting and aren't, and so we would be redeploying. Instead of people entering information into Excel off all the pieces of paper, we should be able to audit our portfolio by doing this. So it's redeploying resources.
The cost, do we have a cost for this?
Chair Benz, right now we have a range of costs because we're still in the requirements gathering phase. It looks like it'll be in a range of about $1.6 to about $2.3 million for the system.
And then the additional folks to operate the system, I mean, I'm trying to get a understanding of what it is that the department has to do differently now that it would have this new system in place.
So, Chair Benz, that picture will become clearer as we further define the requirements, but we're not anticipating at this point in time that we're going to need more people to operate the system. We'll absorb it within existing resources, or if we find out there's a savings, we'll look to redeploy or other alternatives.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we have a, unless there's further questions, would appear to be. Thank you very much. We have Mr. Romaine signed up to speak.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association, and we are very much in favor of 2186. Maureen told you about the 18,000 pieces of paper that we file, that are filed every month. We do that filing. The cost of filling out 18,000 pieces of individual paper when you could do it on a computer quickly, efficiently, there'll be a huge savings to the industry, and we would very much appreciate your support on the bill. ODOT has been wonderful to work with on this. And usually you hear people, especially lobbyists, get up and bash agencies about how difficult it is to work with them. They have gone out of their way to try and figure out a way to make things easier for us, and we appreciate that, and we hope you would work with them. And this truly is a cost savings measure for the industry, and we think it'll help the state a lot too. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Romaine? I have just one. How does the association get the word out? Do you let everybody know through your newsletters or emails that this is going to happen and you ask for a response? How do you come to us today and are able to tell us this? What's the foundation for the testimony?
Mr. Chair, we've been discussing this kind of thing at our board meetings and membership meetings for the last couple of years. We actually came to the legislature with the hope that they could have done it last year, but the agency was working on it, and that really didn't get done. This is just one of those cost savings measures that everybody we've heard from in the agency or in the association has been in agreement on.
Thank you. Questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, I think we will close with that the public hearing on House Bill 2136 and open a work session on 2136. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2136 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Motion has been made to move House Bill 2136 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on, before I close the work session, I need a carrier. Okay, I see one. Carrier will be Representative Widener. Okay. Now we'll close the work session. Okay, with that, let's go back to House Bill 2070, open a public hearing on House Bill 2070, and Paul Grove.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm not Paul Grove. I am Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Business Oregon as well as the Director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. Some of you may recall in the 2009 legislative session, the former Economic and Community Development Department was reorganized. That agency is now the Oregon Business Development Department. And a part of that legislation was the creation of the Infrastructure Finance Authority within the department. That authority has its own constituent board made up of cities, counties, ports, special districts, and special expertise for economic development as well as public finance. And I should point out a few appointed members from the legislature, including your own Representative Beyer. I also should point out that while the Infrastructure Finance Authority was created, the department as a whole retained the Business Development Commission as its oversight body. The 2009 session bill, House Bill 2152, broadly defined the relationship between the IFA Board and the OBDD Commission. However, during the course of a substantial policy document, that being the Ports Statewide Strategic Plan, the relationship and approval authority of the respective board and commission was called into question. The matter was amiably resolved through exploration of the state statute, but the need for clarification of the working relationship was identified. Also, a second question surfaced regarding the board and commission's role regarding the development of the agency's request budget. Current IFA statute does not reflect how agency budgets are developed or the route of submission of that requested budget. The statutory changes requested within the bill establish the IFA budget development as a traditional agency practice that we carry out in accordance with DAS instructions as well as the ultimate commission's endorsement role. House Bill 2070 creates in statutes the obligations and the working relationships between the IFA board and the OBD commission. This is the present working relationship that we carry out. And essentially, the statute assures perpetuation of the board-commission engagement and to meet the obligation to keep each body apprised of each other's activities. The relationship is rather straightforward. Simply put, the IFA board determines the policies and procedures of the IFA and the programs as originally envisioned by House Bill 2152. The commission, as policy-making body for the broader influence of the department, must be provided the opportunity to comment and provide direction on matters relating to infrastructure and public works programs administered by the IFA. Practically, what that translates to is I provide the commission a report at each of their meetings regarding the considerations and actions of the IFA board. And similarly, if the commission has any guidance that wants to provide the IFA board members, I report back to the IFA board on that topic matter. And periodically, the IFA board chair also meets with the commission to ensure open communication. The department does not find that there's any fiscal impact related to this bill, and I think you have a report of that nature. And with that, I'd open it up to any questions that you might have.
Questions? Christina? Well, yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, and while he sees no real cost of this bill, I must say it will certainly help in a matter of cost of time for the members, as we've debated this issue numerous times on the commission. So this will be very helpful to kind of let us give us more of an idea of what our role is. So,
and you are a member.
I am a member of this committee. A non-voting member of the committee, but I am a member of the committee.
Well, thank you for that insight. I did have a question. In Section 2, there's a reference to, it says, subject to the supervision of the administrator of the authority. And I'm, rather than look through this, who is the administrator of the authority?
Mr. Co-Chair, that would be me. And in this balance of the statute, the administrator of the authority is identified and selected by the agency director with the input of the IFA board.
So the idea then is that you would act as the go-between between the commission and the board. That's the concept.
Ms. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's exactly right.
And the concept further is that the board has the, when I read through this, I was having a hard time figuring out just who was in charge, and I assume that's why this language is, why you're doing this. Is that a correct thought?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly right. I think we have a firm understanding at this point in time, but we don't want to allow for future confusion, and so that's why we're putting the working relationship and the present understanding in statute.
And so when I read this, it appeared that the idea is the commission is to be kept informed, but at the end of the day, the board is to be making those decisions. That's where this language is to take us. It's going to be embarrassing if it's not, because this is supposed to clear this up, this language.
Mr. Chair, I think the statute's purpose is to clearly say that the IFA board governs the activities of the IFA, setting its policy and direction. However, in the case and by statute, it verifies that ultimately the commission is the superpower of the department as a whole. So if the IFA board adopted something and went in a direction in conflict with the commission's interests, they would essentially trump the IFA board. The whole point of the communication emphasized in this is to make sure we don't get to that point.
So I'm trying to figure out why we need the board. Does it do a great deal of things the commission would otherwise do? I'm just trying to figure out why we have a board and a commission.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the IFA board was created, as referenced in my testimony, a constituent board. It has members of the cities, counties, ports, and special districts on it, as well as expertise in economic development districts and public finance. Because the programs of the IFA are municipally oriented, the interest was having constituents directly involved with the department and its programs on the IFA side, setting the policy and the program parameters. The commission as a whole is broader interest, dealing with economic development throughout the state. And their expertise is largely directed towards the business development activities of the department.
But the reason I'm raising the issue is having served on the Water Resource Commission for 8 years, we had a series of other groups that wanted to be involved in one way or the other. One that comes to mind is the Groundwater Advisory Committee, which after some period of time, there were numerous thoughts that maybe there should be two water resource commissions as opposed to just the one. And so when I look at this, it reminded me of that circumstance, and I thought, do we really need both? And I guess I could ask the person sitting to my left that question, and perhaps you could, I hate to make you a witness, but what is the, from your observation, you're the administrator, does this organization serve a valid and useful purpose, the Oregon Infrastructure Finance Authority and the board that oversees it?
Mr. Chair, as a member of the committee, I will say I'm somewhat astounded by the level of knowledge in this committee that I don't have. So it's been very eye-opening. But I do think that what you have sitting at this table are the users of these funds, the people who are issuing these funds. And so I think what you have is a much more informed briefing or exploration of the issues that come before us, so that they can be more advised to the commission as a whole. Because I think these are people who don't actually sit on the commission, but they do have an expertise in these issues that I think is very helpful to have at the table.
Thank you very much for that. Anything to add?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I would endorse what Representative Beyer said. Specifically, we have worked on the priorities for the Community Development Block Grant Program. Because the municipalities are the only eligible entities, municipalities being cities and counties, they have particular expertise in where those program funds should have the best impact given current economic certain circumstances as well as infrastructure circumstances. So because of their knowledge on the IFA board, it's very valuable for to have them guiding our direction. We've also talked about the expenses of our programs, and historically we have paid all the bond issuance expenses related to financing projects through consultation with the IFA board and their membership, recognizing again they're the users of those bond programs. We've established a modest fee base now for those costs. So the point being that their expertise, particularly related to the matters of the infrastructure programs, has been very worthwhile to guide our direction, something that probably wouldn't be available through the Business Development Commission.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Representative.
Senator.
Right here.
Well, throw out and whoever wants to answer, but couldn't those committee members or that group still go and report to the commission? I mean, their expertise, they would still want to be involved. So I'm just trying to see why they just wouldn't go to the commission direct, and the purpose of having them together as a committee. I guess I'm kind of following up on what Representative Bent said. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Widener, they act rather expeditiously. They meet every other month. They started out meeting every month. The commission as a whole meets for a very limited amount of time every other month. Their availability and dedication, I think, has really served to advance the programs well. Certainly they could go directly to the commission, but I think the commission is really looking for these constituent experts to help them. As I said, I provide them the information of what's under consideration and their recommendations, and they really value that. So, you know, you could create them as an advisory group to the commission, but because the commission sought to have somebody take care of the programs and the policies, they really preferred to have a board created.
Other questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have no one else signed up to testify on this. So with that, close the public hearing on 2070 and open a work session on 2070.
Mr. Chair, if you're looking for a motion, move House Bill 2070 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
And move that House Bill 2070 go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2070 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a person to carry the bill?
Mr. Chair, I might suggest that House Bill 2070 could be a candidate for the consent calendar.
Any objection? Seeing none, consent calendar. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2070 and have it placed on the consent calendar. That brings us to House Bill 2335, and I'll open a public hearing on that and ask Zach to tell us about the bill.
House Bill 2335 clarifies that federal funding received by the Oregon Department of Transportation for the purposes of highway workforce development refers to federal funding received each biennium.
Who do we have? 2335. And it looks like we have Michael Cobb, ODOT.
Good afternoon, Chairman Benz and committee members. My name is Michael Cobb. I am the manager of the Oregon manager of the Office of Civil Rights for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as it was read, the Oregon law requires ODOT to set aside 0.5% of its federal funding to help to increase diversification of its workforce. And that amount of funding cannot exceed $1.5 million. The law, as it is stated, it was understood and interpreted by the agency that it meant for each biennium, but 2335 simply clarifies the fact that it does indeed mean each biennium.
Well, that's to the point.
Like that.
we understood it to be that, as it is. So the bill made it very nice and simplified it for us.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair. Has this been an issue at all with ODOT?
No. No, it hasn't. It was not. We had interpreted the law to mean per biennium.
So this is just kind of in case somebody does come along and create a problem.
Just clarifying and confirming.
Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could just, I wasn't here last time, so I'm wondering if you could give a little bit of procedural background, maybe what the intent was. Does that 0.5% over 100 years? It sounds like you're saying that the intent was per biennium, but maybe you can give a little background of how we arrived to that.
Sure.
Interpretation.
As contracts are awarded with federal funds, committee chairman and committee members, as ODOT contracts out its funding, those projects that have federal funding, we are required to set aside one half of 1%, not to exceed $1.5 million per biennium, to go towards establishing pre-apprenticeship and supportive services programs that would help to diversify the workforce. That workforce, of course, are those workers that would wind up on ODOT projects. So there is indeed, we contract out with BOLI. We have a partnership with BOLI, Bureau of Labor Industries, and through that process, they in turn contract out to those providers, such as Oregon Trades Women's, there's ETAP, Portland Community College, and other supportive service providers that recruit, orient, assess. They actually do CASAS testing in some cases to determine these pre-apprentices, their levels of training and understanding, and then progress them on through and prepare them to enter into a full-time recognized apprenticeship opportunity. And then from there, the apprentices are hired by the contractors that we do business with. So that law was in effect, and like I said, we had understood it to mean per biennium, and this law clarified it. So it's a supportive services program that ODOT has run for many years on its projects. Okay, does that help any?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
I have no one else signed up to testify on House Bill 2335. So with that, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2335. We do have the fiscal and revenue statements on this, as we have on the other two.
Mr. Chair, I might suggest that House Bill 2335 could be the winner in a session-long contest for the shortest and most succinct and most to the point bill we're likely to see. And therefore, I move House Bill 2335 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2335 moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection?
Well, seeing that Mr. Reed wants it to move kind of fast, maybe I should object, but I think I'll sustain from doing that.
Hearing no objections. The House Bill 2335 moves to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Everyone use the consent calendar again.
Mr. Chair, I think the consent calendar might be very appropriate for this bill.
Any objection? Seeing none. On the consent calendar, close the work session on House Bill 2335 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2069. And who do we have? Zach, if you could read the nature of the bill or explain it.
House Bill 2069 amends the initial loan terms from the Special Public Works Fund to 30 years from 25 years for the usable life of the project, whichever is less.
And you're back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I'm back.
So
my name
please.
Is Thank Lynn Chesler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department as well as the Administrator of the Infrastructure Finance Authority.
Okay.
House Bill 2069 addresses our Special Public Works Loan Program. It's administered by the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and municipalities throughout the state rely upon it to finance infrastructure projects as well as
create opportunities for job creation in addition to the traditional addressing health, safety, and quality of life issues. Two situations confront the IFA as it works with communities. First of all is trying to get the most affordable systems in place that solve the community's problems, as well as trying to make sure the system that we approve is the highest quality possible. As utilities become more and more expensive, the affordability or the yearly debt payment that the municipality must pay to us, that becomes an issue. Municipalities, for obvious reasons, want the lowest possible monthly user charges for their residents. To enhance the project affordability, House Bill 2069 proposes to extend the debt service period or the loan repayment period an additional 5 years, increasing the repayment period to 30 years from the current 25-year limit that's in statute. This will moderately reduce monthly user charges, but it will make a difference to the local user. Also, the quality of systems that assure the longest life cycle is important to the IFA, and often a higher quality system with an increased useful life will require additional upfront development expenses, and this in part addresses that circumstance as well. The second issue addressed by the bill responds to what may happen locally over the life of a project, and that is that circumstances may result in a community being faced with the inability to make their structured payments to the state. That could be due to a natural disaster. It could be due to the loss of a major employer in a small community. Regardless, the present statute sets a limitation of 25 years for the loan to be repaid, regardless of circumstance. We can defer payments at present, but they have to be tacked on within that same 25 years and essentially result in a balloon payment at some point in time, which puts this community right back in the same problem that they had when they couldn't make their payments in the first place. What this bill does is creates the opportunity for that 30-year debt service to be renegotiated or the useful remaining life of the system. So for 5 years into a project's payment and they have to suspend their payments, they could re-amortize it for another 30 years if there's 30 years of life left in the system and put them back on track with that payment schedule that they originally signed up for. And with that, that pretty much summarizes the bill, and I'd be open to respond to any questions that you might have.
Questions? Yes, Mr. Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there currently a mechanism in place to refinance these things right now, or is this just one shot at this loan? They get it, they pay it off over 25 years, and it's done?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Sheehan, we don't necessarily call it refinance because with a bond program, if you start about talking about refinancing projects, it gets into all complications related to that bond provisions. What we prefer to recall it is a restructuring, so we can restructure the payments and provide them an opportunity to meet their obligation without having to go through a formal refinancing and spreading their payments out.
Further questions? Yes, Representative
Weiner. I'm supportive of what you're trying to do here, but I'm wondering if there's not more that needs to be done on it, because I'm not a huge supporter of bonding things for long term. So I think we should be saving more money up front to have more money to pay for the projects as we go. But when we take this from 25 to 30, this is going to allow people who already have loans to fall into that. So it's going to be retroactive, or is this just going to be from this point going forward on new bonding?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Widener, this is only for problem projects that come to our attention hereafter. So if a community has a 25-year loan with us now and they're making their payments, we're not providing them the opportunity to refinance it or restructure it for 30 years just because they want to. We're going to keep with the original schedule. If something should happen in your community, they can't make their payment, and you know we don't get their payment, we'll begin working with them to see, based upon this authority, if we can restructure it so they can pick up their payments.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading the language that says that the term may not exceed the useful life of the project or 30 years. Could you comment generally on what portion of the total get up to that upper limit? I'm guessing that there's probably some who use a lesser term than that maximum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, members of the committee, just about everybody at the present, for the sake of getting the least payment to their users, opts for the 25 years. I would guess in the future that people will certainly look at 30 years. It's a modest difference. I'm sure they will want to, for the sake of their users, amortize 30 years. Frankly, the systems we hope have, you know, it depends on which part of the system you're talking about. Pipes in the ground, we hope that they have a 50-year life. Sewage lagoons, 30 years is probably the max, assuming you put in a quality lagoon in the first place. So, if a project comes into a problem 10 years into the life cycle, if we can't, by an engineer's estimate, gauge that there's another 30 years left, we're only going to go that number of years that's still remaining in the useful life.
Thank you.
It would be interesting to me if you could explain when the authority or the Special Public Works Fund and the Infrastructure Finance Authority makes a loan, it must take back something in the form of security. It's interesting to think about the type of security we enjoy in a sewage lagoon. But when we're looking at a situation like this and you're called in, the concept must be we've got to figure out a way of getting this municipality to be able to repay us. Is that what's really going on? Because what are our alternatives given the nature of the security we have securing the note?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can assure you the last thing I want to do is own a sewage treatment plant. What we do is we pledge the general revenues as a community towards payment of the debt. That's after we've calculated that they indeed are imposing user charges on their citizens that pay the debt and the operating reserve up front. Like I say, circumstances where they fall into a problem, then we'll start talking about the restructuring. But never do I want to own a railroad, a sewage treatment plant, or a water treatment plant.
Correct. And so it seems to me that this is another tool that you truly need to have available for communities that are challenged, and given the alternatives, I think it's a great idea. That's my thinking on it. But, well, further questions? Thank you very much. I see no one else signed up for this bill, so with that I will close the public hearing on 2069 and open a work session on 2069. Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2069 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2069 pass to the floor on a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? See none. For the purpose of the record, I should note that this has not been a unanimous effort on our part because Representative Jefferson Smith is not here. And whether that has anything to do with the speed at which we're getting this work done, I don't know. But the record is now clear that he isn't here. See no objections. House Bill 2069 has passed. I need a carrier or consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest it's probably not appropriate for the consent calendar given just exactly the nature of the discussion we've had here. It probably does deserve a brief explanation on the floor.
Mr. Chair, would you? I can take care of this.
I would very much appreciate you carrying the bill, Representative Beyer. Thank you. Co-Chair Beyer. Thank you very much. Co-Chair Beyer will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on 2069. And I don't see anything further to come before us. So with that, I believe we're adjourned.